I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Saturday marks the 20th anniversary of the September 11th terror attacks on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the forced crash landing of United Flight 93 in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. 2,996 people from 78 countries died that day, including airline pilots, attendants and passengers, office workers, firefighters, paramedics, police officers, and the 19 hijackers. I was working at WHYY that terrible morning, and after witnessing the second plane fly into the second Twin Tower, I went on the air to try to keep our listeners informed as producers scrambled to find guests, ran into the studio with the latest news, and I watched the TV coverage in horror as commentators described what was happening with growing alarm. Here's CNN's Carol Lynn and then CBS Bryant Gumbel talking with a witness.
This just in, you are looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center.
Did you hear the explosion from your position?
Yes, we did. As a matter of fact, we heard it, and because I was just like standing there pretty much looking out the window, I didn't see what caused it or if there was an impact.
So you have no idea right
oh,
now?
Oh, there's another one. Another plane just hit. Right? Oh, my God. Another plane has just hit. It hit another building. Flew right into the middle of it. Explosion. My God, it's right in the middle of the building.
This one into the East Tower.
Yes.
Later that morning, the Pentagon was attacked. Here's CBS reporter David Martin.
There is a lot of confusion here at the Pentagon. It appears that something hit the Pentagon on the outside of the fifth corridor. Emergency services personnel were rushing to reports of several people trapped in the building. Most of the building's 24,000 people are outside of the building.
And finally, a report from Shanksville, Pennsylvania, from then CNN anchor Judy Woodruff.
Near Shanksville, a small town in Somerset County, about 80 miles south of Pittsburgh. This the side of one of the two United Airlines aircraft. This a Boeing 757 left Newark, New Jersey this morning on its way to San Francisco.
Today in Radio Times, we remember September 11th, the collective grief and trauma, the acts of heroism, the enduring images, what has happened in the intervening years, and what, if anything, it all means. Joining us is Barbie Zelizer. She's author, associate dean, and director of the Center for Media at Risk at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Barbie Zelizer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me back again.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Dr. Dan Gottlieb. He's with us here in our Philadelphia studio, clinical psychologist, former host of WHYY's Voices in the Family. You can hear his weekly commentaries with Mike and Scott Mondays during Morning Edition, also here on WHYY. And Dan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times
Marty,
as well.
Nice to be with you.
You know, listening to those reports, I don't know about you, Barbie Zelizer, but I was taken back to that morning, September 11th, 2001. How about you?
Oh, yeah. I think that my heart rate went up majorly just as I was listening to the reports. And I think that most listeners have that exact effect. They can't get past the actual visceral kind of immediacy of what we were going through then.
How about for you, Dan?
Yeah, it's the same thing. My heart rate went up. I was aware of feeling fear just like I did 20 years ago. Helplessness and confusion, and all of those emotions are intolerable over time.
Over time. I mean, but you can't live with those emotions, right?
No, the body can't handle it.
You know, one of my memories of this day, and it's almost perverse to say this, after listening to those clips was, and I'll look at you, Dan, what a beautiful day it was. It was one of those crispy, early fall days, blue skies. You know, the humidity of the summer was gone. It felt like fall is coming. You can start to wear sweaters again. And then, of course, all the horror that happened after that.
Boy, it sure was a beautiful day that day. I was seeing patients at my house. A couple was walking down the hallway towards my office. I met them in the hallway. My nurse was sitting in the kitchen that we passed, and she was watching TV, and we saw the plane go into the second building, and all of us just stopped and froze. And eventually, the couple and I made our way into my office. Like, what do you talk about?
Yeah. What did you talk about?
Well, they had a friend who worked there. And we all talked about our fear together, our like I just said, Marty, our helplessness. And, of course, we didn't talk about what they came to therapy for. And, you know, they left early to try to find their friend.
How about for you, Barbie? What did you do that day?
Yeah, I remember I was in the car. I was driving to Penn and when the first plane hit. And I walked into the entranceway at the Annenberg School when the second plane hit. And I remember just everybody standing there in sheer anguish. Nobody was moving. Nobody was saying anything. We were just glued to the television. And the hard thing, as Dan just said, is that, you know, the day goes on and you have these feelings. And I remember later on that day, I had meetings with students, and a student came into my office and wanted not to talk about September, about what was happening. And I pushed back, and I could not engage with anything else.
Well, it's interesting you raise that, because I have a question about not talking about September 11th now as we, you know, mark the 20th anniversary. And Barbie, let me go back to you since you mentioned that. And I've heard from a number of people, which is, I don't want to see the pictures. I don't want to watch the documentaries. I frankly don't want to think about it. Do we need to do this, do you think, Barbie?
Well, you know, I don't think that there's one we out there. I don't think that everybody needs to do it. I think there are people who still need to do it. And I think that, you know, this is what collective memory is about. It's about how we remember the past to help us make sense of the present, right? It's not about retrieving the past. It's about reconfiguring it for whatever it is we're wrestling with today. And so I think that the question of the anxiety and uncertainty and lack of clarity that is still wrapped up in 9/11 continues to permeate our engagement with the event. And some people don't want to do it, and that's fine. And some people really need to do it, and I think that's fine, too.
I'd be curious, Dan, what you think about that.
Well, it's the same thing with mourning. You know, we all mourn differently, and this is kind of the same thing. Some of us do need to go back. Personally, I do.
Why do you need to go back?
As a way of taking ownership of my life, of my experience, of my country, of that national trauma, it is a way of taking ownership. I've got great respect for people who want to turn their heads and are okay with it. Some people turn their heads and symptoms pop up as a result, and that's a whole different category. You know, they bury all these emotions that I mentioned earlier are intolerable, and they come out. You know, all buried emotions are buried alive, and that's where we see these symptoms of post-traumatic stress.
What we are also, if we choose to, remembering, and I'm back to you, Dan, in the middle of a pandemic, you know, where you feel like the world is in crisis once again, there is anxiety, there is fear, there is confusion, that we're sort of in the same boat, although obviously dealing with something very different from a terrorist attack.
Yeah, it's a very, very different boat. With 9/11, we had a common enemy. We united around this common enemy. George W. Bush's approval rating went up to 90 in the wake of that. Everybody was wearing NYPD logos on whatever. We united because we had a common enemy. The pandemic is the opposite. I mean, we search for an enemy. We, you know, and it's China, it's the government, it's Fauci, it's, you know, we're searching for an enemy, but there is none.
Yeah.
We can't find one. The enemy is our own vulnerability. Talk about intolerable.
Yeah, and it's an invisible virus versus all those images that we see. And Barbie, speaking of images, I mean, I do think, you know, I posted the photo of the falling man on our Facebook page. Some people were really angry that I did that, felt that I was, in a sense, almost re-traumatizing them. But we're going to see lots of images, lots of video in the next couple of days. From your perspective, what's the importance of that?
Well, I'll offer a minority position here. I'm not convinced that seeing those images always re-traumatizes us. I think that any kind of mediated representation is a way to kind of get to the other side of what trauma does to us. And I mean, just kind of building on what Dan just said, I mean, I think that yes, we were given an enemy. We learned that there was an enemy. We were schooled in the idea that there was an enemy, but there was a lot of other things going on at the same time. And I think that what is particularly difficult right now in this moment in thinking about collective memory and 9/11 is that the narrative didn't hold up, right? And so many of the things that we were troubled by, like American exceptionalism or overreach or complacency or brutality that have come out in the 20 years since 9/11, that is a reason, right, that many people are needing to go back and say, where did this start? Why did this start? Why did this take the shape that it did at the time?
You're talking about the two wars that we had in these intervening years, Barbie?
Absolutely. I'm talking not only about the two wars in the intervening years, but the set of assumptions that accompanied those two wars as we moved on from the anguish, right, trying to make sense of it and get to the other side, right? And I think not everybody got to the other side. Not everybody reached clarity. And I think that as the narratives got somewhat mixed up and confused and jumbled over two decades, it becomes almost more important to see the original triggers, right, that led us down this path.
Dan, we're about a minute before our first break here, but, you know, the sort of bookends where we have pulled out of Afghanistan, we went into Afghanistan as a result of the terror attacks, so we have this sort of strange symmetry here.
The technical word is consolidation, and that's what happens with the traumatic memory. It goes into your brain, it gets locked in there, and what Barbie's talking about is unlocking that and adding in new data, new information, so that we can integrate it better. Some are able to do it, some are not.
Yeah. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That very familiar voice is Dr. Dan Gottlieb, clinical psychologist. He hosted WHYY's Voices in the Family for many, many years. You can now hear his weekly commentaries with Mike and Scott Mondays on WHYY during Morning Edition. Barbie Zelizer is with us as well. She's an author, associate dean, director of the Center for Media at Risk at the Annenberg School for Communication. That's at the University of Pennsylvania. We are remembering September 11th, the anniversary of the terror attacks, coming up on Saturday, 20 years since 2001. We want to hear from you. Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us, WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with our guest Dan Gottlieb and Barbie Zelizer as we mark the 20th anniversary of the September 11th terror attacks, talking about understanding collective grief and trauma, the enduring images of that day, which we will talk about, the aftermath, and of course, what, if anything, it all means. And again, you can join us by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Dan, from a clinical perspective, what is traumatic memory? What does trauma do to memory?
Well, like I suggested before the break, it consolidates. It gets locked in there. Our limbic system gets overwhelmed and can't integrate it. Our frontal cortex, the logical part of our brain, goes offline because we're overwhelmed with these emotions. So We can't think our way out of it. We can't think our way through it. And it just gets locked in our brain as is. And it's difficult to get out. And that's why people get triggered. That's why we see these reactions, these nightmares, similar to what all three of us said when we heard those news clips. Mm. You know, it just brought us back to the same emotions.
Barbie, can we trust our memory from 20 years ago?
Can we trust our memory from yesterday? This isn't about trust, right? This isn't about authenticity. This is about relevance, right? It's about the degree to which a memory, partial though it may be, static, dynamic as it may be, it's the degree to which that does work for us, right? I mean, I always like to say that memories are not things we think about. They are tools we think with. And so the question really is, to what agenda, for what purpose are we using our memories? And I think that, you know, when we're talking about trauma, you know, one way of looking at trauma is just a memory that can't be integrated back into experience, right? Mm-hmm. It's a memory without context. And I think that's, as Dan just said, you know, we when we are focused on our emotions, we don't have the story. We're just so close, right, to the fear and anxiety and anguish and uncertainty that we can't really see the bigger picture. And I think that is where we need to be engaging with representation in order to get us past trauma, in order to get us working through the pain.
I do want to talk about some of that representation, some of the photographs that we think of on September 11th. But Dan, just giving you a chance to respond to what Barbie said, does that mean that our memories, even if they're distorted, even if they're traumatic, that they somehow serve us? They're telling us something?
Well, they do serve us, but it could be very destructive and it could be very helpful. So if our memory about 9/11 is that this happened as a result of, you know, aggression on their part, aggression on our part, whatever story we need to tell, that's okay. But if the story we create as a result is about government conspiracy or intentionality internally, that, you know, it works for us because we have a story. We need a story. But in the long run, it's destructive individually and socially.
Let me go back to you, Barbie, and some of what you have spent your life work on is sort of how media creates narratives and images that we all absorb and you know, I guess make sense of in our own kinds of ways. There's a lot of media these days. There certainly was a lot of media back in 2001. I guess my question is, when we see some of those images, and I'll just add that I put a picture of the falling man, that infamous photograph from September 11th of a man head first, you know, he's either jumped or he's fallen out of the World Trade Center. It was taken by an AP photographer, Richard Drew. He's on his way to death. I mean, it's certain death. And there he is, you know, all by himself, the buildings in the background. And time has kind of stopped as we look at him. What's the importance of that photograph?
Wow. I mean, I think that photograph structurally is very much like the burning towers, right, of the World Trade Center. These are photos that have kind of, they kind of encapsulate the most decisive moment in the actual sequence of events. And they're not dead yet, right? The person falling mm-hmm. from the building is not dead yet. The buildings are not down yet. And I what I have argued for quite a long time now is that that kind of photo allows for us to engage much more powerfully than when we look at simple devastation, which kind of, you know, it doesn't leave us with many options to actually emotionally engage with what we're seeing. So there's, even if this is not rational engagement, mm-hmm. it might be hope, It might be the irrational sense that maybe he doesn't die in the end, or maybe the burning towers, the fire gets extinguished. But I think the important thing is that taking that moment midstream is an enormously potent, enormously generative kind of photo. And it's the kind of photo that we tend to get whenever we have crises that are difficult, are unresolved, and are riding on deep-seated problematic emotions. If I could just go back one second, I think that it's really important, Marty, to accentuate the fact that our memories are mediated memories. Even if one was there to actually experience the event, the way in which we learn about the event and relearn about the event every year for 20 years is through the media. And so we have to kind of take the media as an actor, right, or as a set of actors into the story and think about, you know, why are the media telling the story in this way? I totally agree with Dan that we need a story, but there are multiple stories out there. But the media, it's really important to recognize that, you know, they make us feel like we're there even if we're not, right? They and so we cling to these mediated memories because really they're all that we've got.
Yeah.
And because the emotions are still so strong, it's kind of like an addiction, right? We just have to go back to kind of replenish them with hopes that it will get us somewhat closer to closure.
Let me go back to this photograph, and Dan, go back to you. Richard Drew was the AP photographer who took it, and he, you know, from his perspective, he was surrounded by all this mayhem and chaos and, you know, frankly, falling bodies. But he said this was a quiet photograph. There was no blood. There were no guts. And he thinks of this person, and apparently we do not know who it is, as a kind of unknown soldier. He becomes the everyman for that particular day. And frankly, for me, it helped me sort of process what that image is all about.
Yeah, and I have to say it didn't help me. I was unaware of this photograph until you and I spoke about it earlier, and I saw the photograph yesterday, and I literally had to turn my head away, which is interesting because I have come very close to death many times. I have, figuratively speaking, been falling out of a building several times, and I didn't need to turn my head on my own death, but that falling man, I needed to turn my head.
There was a lot of reactions, some liking it, some didn't. I'll read a couple of comments. One from Laurie: this image and others like it are filled with and reflect the terror and disorientation of that day. They are deeply disturbing and should be posted with a content warning. How do we honor those who suffered the most that day? How do we treat their suffering with dignity? How do we respect their loved ones still grieving? A comment from Stroud: I think images and sounds of that day should be broadcast. I remember watching the firemen on the ground floor coordinating the evacuation and rescue. Most of that video died when the tower collapsed. Why would we wish to wash over the horror of that day? Two very different perspectives. Barbie, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's interesting that we don't know who the falling man is, despite the fact that there have been scores of attempts to delineate exactly his identity. And so one has to ask, for how long will we continue to try and figure out the identity of this particular man? Why is it so difficult to leave him as a symbol? Because he is a symbol. I think that we will continue to kind of grapple with that. Precisely because he's this kind of weird, the picture is a kind of weird composite of specificity and generalizability, right? It's specific. We know that this is a person who was in the World Trade Center. Theories have said that he was a food worker, and we know exactly what's happening to him, and we know exactly where it's happening and when it's happening. But we need these kind of iconic photos that onto which we can kind of jumble or kind of posit all of our emotions, right? And so he serves a purpose. And I think that we will continue to think about that identity, even though we know that we'll never find out.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, Dan. I know you want to add something. That's Barbie Zellers or Dan Gottlieb, our guest today in Radio Times. We are reflecting back on what happened almost 20 years ago today, September 11th, 2001. Dan?
Marty, you referred to this man as kind of the unknown soldier. And what do we do with the unknown soldier every year? We lay a wreath there. We honor them. And the first... listener talked about honoring them. And as a clinician, as a psychotherapist, I know that the best way to heal, the best way to manage intolerable memories like this is to help others, is to be in the service of other, because all our anguish is about self. Right. And when we turn our gaze to the outside, it gets integrated better.
Barbie, let me go back to you and actually go back to another picture. It's one taken by Robert Capa, who's often described as the sort of preeminent war photographer. It's a photo from the Spanish Civil War. It's of a man getting shot. It's literally the moment of his death. I looked it up yesterday in to compare it to The Falling Man. It's called The Falling Soldier, which really shocked me. But, I mean, this is this iconic image from yet, you know, another war, the Spanish Civil War.
Right. I mean, this is what I call the About to Die image. And, again, they appear across wars, across acts of terrorism, across natural disasters, across accidents. We always look for that one photo. And, you know, the interesting thing is these kinds of photos, very much like the Richard Drew photo of the Falling Man, these kinds of photos often generate extensive conversation and discourse about what exactly the photographer was doing, right? Yeah. So we always get the backstory as if the backstory somehow stands in, right, for that context, for the larger event. And it's interesting that the Richard Drew photo has persevered in much the same way as the Capa photo did, whereas other photos of 9/11 did not persevere. And I want to just kind of juggle everybody's memory about photos that appeared in the very first days after 9/11, which was of people in the World Trade Center leaning out of the windows, right, and waving. And they appeared literally the next, because this was, of course, on television. They appeared on television, and then the next day they appeared in newspapers. Literally, by that weekend, they were gone, right? And so one has to say, why did those disappear? And the Falling Man persevered. And I think it's because this About to Die image, this visual emblem, right, of all the difficulty, it's the one image that somehow gives us a sense that we can do work with our emotions, that we can somehow heal in some way.
Let me pick up on this. This is a little weird segue, but I wanted to ask it anyway. And Dan, I'll go back to you. But hearing both you and Barbie talk, I was sort of wondering, so why do we go to the Holocaust Museum? Why do we go to the African American History Museum? Why do we go to the Vietnam Memorial? I mean, we do things to honor the dead, to remember the dead, to remember people we've never met, you know, to see images, to see videos. I mean, much of that, absolutely horrifying, and yet, you know, it's part of a kind of homage that we bring to people who have died.
So you called it a weird segue. I'm going to give you a weird answer. My experience, I was, as many people know, sexually abused when I was 12 years old, and I recently went back to that neighborhood where I was abused. I don't know why. I went to the corner where that house was. I began to cry. I thought about details of the house, of that event. And in my mind, in my heart, I went up and I took that boy out of the house, that 12-year-old, and I took him home with me. So that's a weird answer to your question. What are we doing? Why do we do it? That's why.
Yeah. Barbie, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that it's a very good question because it underscores how we need to remember collectively. We need to remember with others. We need to know at some level that our memory of 9/11 is not just ours personally, right? But that everybody around us or most people around us share some semblance of that memory. And I think that that's why these kinds of all of the institutions that hold some aspect of memory, and I would argue that the media are key here, that's why they're so important, right? They're so important because they help us work through the past, and they help us work through the past in ways that help us understand ourselves in some kind of collective identity, right? Not just us alone, but we as part of a larger group.
I was thinking of a visit my husband and I took a number of years ago. We were in Poland to Auschwitz. And what shocked me, I thought maybe we would be of a, you know, a handful of people that were there. There were busloads and busloads and busloads of people from all over the world there for what we were there for, which was to try to understand the horror of the Holocaust. Dan?
Yeah, I'm thinking about these pictures and, the ones we never forget. And I'm thinking about the picture of that young girl in Vietnam who was burning, and it's the same thing. You know what's going to happen to that child, and that picture doesn't leave your consciousness. But I would argue that that picture, in a way, helped us get out of Vietnam. It stoked our anger about being in Vietnam. These other pictures, they lead to discussion in the service of collective understanding, collective working it through. I don't know.
Let me take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Dan Gottlieb, clinical psychologist, former host of WHYY's Voices in the Family, Barbie Zelizer, author, associate dean, director of the Center for Media at Risk at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. We are thinking about, talking about, remembering September 11th. We're coming up on the 20th anniversary this Saturday. We got lots of comments here. I want to read them after our very short break. You can send us your comments, radiotimes at whyy.org. You can tweet us at whyy radio times, and you can always call us 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Let me read some comments here. Keith says, my grandmother was growing up when Pearl Harbor was attacked. I witnessed the Kennedy assassination, and I remember sitting down with my daughter when 9/11 happened. I sometimes wonder what will happen for my daughter's soon-to-arrive child. Question from Melanie. Do your guests think or worry that this anniversary will lead to renewed Islamophobia in our increasingly angry and separatist society? Let me just hold on to that question and just read a couple of more. One from Roger. I was in third grade when the attacks happened and didn't have a clear picture of that day or immediately following. But over the years, it's like I began filling in the gaps. I now remember how my family felt and kids leaving school early. We were too young to process what was going on, like a delayed trauma. One more comment from Ali. I'm an Iraqi Arab. I was 14 years old, and I remember my uncle running frantically saying, turn on the TV now. Everyone was silent. Then my dad said, one way or another, Iraq will pay the price for this. My dad's words still haunt me to this day. Let me pick up on Melanie's question first, and I'll toss this to you, Barbie, about whether marking this anniversary will lead to some kind of increased Islamophobia. Do you think that could happen? I don't know if we're more or less divided today. It certainly feels like we're more divided.
I think we are more divided, and I mean it's hard to say that one event will accelerate enmity. I think there are a number of events that are accelerating enmity. I think that we're in a moment already where we have mounting Islamophobia. But I think the question really is, do we when we engage with 9/11, right, do we think of it as the kind of end of 20 years, right, since it happened? Or do we think of it as the beginning, right, of what's to come? And I think that there's a generativity, a productivity that's kind of built into memory if we could just learn to look there, right, to understand this is what we made sense of then. I mean, you know, I the why us, right? The why us refrain at that moment in time is haunting because it's still with us, right? Why aren't we asking why them? Why aren't we asking why have things happened in the world, including in the United States, often, you know, by the United States and often by other nation states? Why are these things happening? What is this telling us about our larger ecosphere? And I think, you know, it's hard to say that one event actually changes, but one event only happens because our interpretations of an event happen because we are at a point in which we're ready to interpret in that way. And if I could just go back really quickly to Dan's recall of the photo of the My Lai girl, the little girl running the napalm girl. You know, that photo did change the consensus around the Vietnam War, but that was the fourth photo in a series of four very gruesome, very difficult photos, beginning with burning monks, going through My Lai, that did not generate the kind of public outrage that the napalm girl finally did. And so I think that, you know, the reaction to remembering these events also works with a kind of dynamism in how we engage with those around us. Not a very clear answer in the sense that there's not a clear resolution, but there's no question that these memories are doing their work on us.
Well, I mean, there's so many ways to talk about this, Dan, but one of the reasons you're here is how we process this stuff personally and by ourselves. You and I probably have very different responses, for instance, to that photograph or even to that day.
Yeah, I'm sure we do. We all do. We hold on to it because we need to. Thinking, Marty, of the larger context here. 9/11, we were united as a country, albeit temporarily, but we were united. We mourned together. Well, looking at what's happening today with COVID, and there's no together here. We're isolated. Even our loved ones, you know, I've been talking to a lot of doctors and nurses, frontline people, and their helplessness, their patients who are dying alone without family. And, you know, 9/11 together, tsunamis together. This COVID is alone, and that changes the dynamic. It's almost like we're reaching out and our hand reaching out. And there's no one to touch out there, no one to grasp.
Yeah, I mean, that's powerful. Barbie, please add to that.
Could I add on? Sorry, I love that you're bringing up COVID, Dan, because I don't love that. Well, we'll leave that to the side.
Yes, no, right. We get it.
But I think it's really interesting. I mean, I have been searching, not only I have, but many of my colleagues have been searching for what is the picture of COVID. In other words, what is the image by which we can come together and understand this particular period? And I have to say, I don't see one emerging yet. I mean, other than the very scientific red swirl that we saw in the very beginning, I don't know that we have an emblematic image. And so that too is important to recognize, is that the ability to even identify, to gather around, to sustain a particular image as emblematic of an event already suggests that we're already beginning to work our way through the trauma or through the grief. And I think that, you know, with COVID, we just have not been able to do that yet.
But Barbie, do we need an image? I mean, does that help us?
I would argue we do need images.
I would agree.
I mean, this,
yep.
I think that images are extraordinarily potent tools of representation, and they're potent because they're suggestive, right? They're potent because it's not like reading a narrative, right? Where you have to say, well, does this parallel my experience? A photo or an image or a movie has to do is suggest a parallel, and your imagination is already filling in the details that make it particularly relevant and powerful for you. So I think images absolutely are essential, and I think that it's part of a society's capacity to come to grips with unsettled, difficult events and problems.
Sure, go ahead, Dan.
I would raise a question. How do you take a photograph? How do you create an image of an ache to touch, a longing? How do you take a picture of a grief, of desperately wanting what we had yesterday? How do we take a picture of our fear of what's going to happen tomorrow? That's the difficulty. And this ache, this longing is so powerful, and we can't even describe it accurately, let alone take a picture of it, see it.
Here's a tweet from VW. My family remembers the Pentagon more than the Twin Towers. Please remember it on your show today. There were four planes and not two. Yes, I mentioned that at the top, and you're right. We have largely focused on the images, you know, that we see largely from September 11th. Let me just make sure our listeners can also continue to join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And like VW, you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Barbie, let me go back to you. But Dan, I'd be interested in your thoughts as well. But I wonder whether with these, you know, horrific public events, whether that breeds on some level, not misinformation, but disinformation, conspiracy theories. I mean, we all, you know, that were paying attention and alive, you know, 20 years ago, we watched what happened. But people are going to come away with different narratives and different belief systems. Is there something about a traumatic public event, Barbie, that can breed conspiracy theories?
Yes, because a traumatic memory, right, is a memory without context. Of course it breeds disinformation and misinformation. But I guess the question that I would pose back to you, Marty, is do we not engage with them because they have this potential? I mean, misinformation and disinformation is the downside of the suggestibility that I mentioned earlier that is associated all the time with images, right? And so I think that we have to trust in our judgment, I think, to a greater, more confident extent in the way that we have to share information about these. We cannot always block information, what we can do, misinformation, but what we can do is correct it. And that's where we are right now. But yes, of course, misinformation and disinformation accompany any event that is unsettled. And, you know, the definition of an unsettled event is that things are not known, right? And that's exactly where conspiracy theories jump in.
Well, and don't we, Dan, we seek out confirmation bias, right? We seek out information that fits our narrative.
And why do we do that? Because we cannot tolerate not knowing. We cannot tolerate our own helplessness. We can't tolerate our own ignorance. And if we could, we could sit with this until it does make sense. We could go back. We could have discussions. But there's certain emotions we just can't tolerate.
Yeah. I wanted to read just a paragraph from a piece that a woman named Kimberly Rex wrote in the Washington Post just a couple of days ago. My father was killed on September 11th. I still struggle to understand how he just disappeared. And she ends by saying, 20 long years have passed since that painful day. So much of my life has happened. I graduated college, taught high school English for 8 years, met and married my husband. I've been gravely sick and recovered. I adopted 2 babies and watched them grow into lovely little girls. So many things to feel happy about. But I never stopped struggling to understand how my father's strong, stocky body just went away, disintegrated. The need to find him has never left, nor the sadness of knowing I never will. Dan, if I can go back to you, I mean, to me, obviously painful, but here she's living a full life and she lives with this pain. And I'm just thinking about all those people that lost someone that day.
Scar tissue, Marnie. You know, I deal with sores. And when they heal, they leave scar tissue. And scar tissue is not pretty. And in a way, it's tougher than regular tender skin. And it is part of us. It's scar tissue. When our hearts break, when we heal, there's scar tissue.
But what struck me is she's living a full life and yet forever will wonder about her father and miss him.
Yeah, of course. That's the missing's not going to go away. The longing is not going to go away. And if we can, in a weird way, Marty, make peace with that, make peace with our own scar tissue and our own longing, then that quickly becomes a part of our lives, a part of the narrative and not the narrative.
Right. Barbie, I was reading that something like 1,000 bodies were not recovered or are still missing from September 11th, which, you know, is absolutely horrifying to think that. But I'm thinking about people still literally looking for their loved ones they lost that day, 20 years later.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a horrific thought, even in the abstract. And I think Dan is right. I mean, I think that the suffering, it will not go away. It will change shape, right? It will attach itself to different kinds of incidents in that author's life and our own lives. But again, I think that there's something to be said for the fact that we can revisit this, right? That we can go back, right, and understand where we are now vis-a-vis what we originally knew. I think that can be a growth experience.
Barbie, let me go back to you. And President Biden just announced that the investigation into the Saudis, you know, alleged involvement in September 11th will now be released. I don't know how much detail we're going to get, but in terms of closure or some of these unanswered questions, how significant do you think that is?
Well, I think it's very significant for the families of victims and for the first responders, all of whom had said to Biden, President Biden, that they did not want him at the memorials unless he actually did this. Again, I think that what we want is information. What we want is completeness. What we want is a sense that the more information that we have, the closer we will get to understanding this event. I don't know that that's true. I don't know that that's ever going to happen, but it is part of our trying to grapple with the event's monstrosity at some level.
Dan, we're almost out of time. Closure. Do you like the word closure? Is that what we should be seeking?
I actually hate the word closure. there really is no such thing. It's like scar tissue. You know, when people ask me about quadriplegia, you know, are you over it yet? Well, come on. You know, no, there is no such thing as closure. However, there is such a thing as resilience. There is such a thing as post-traumatic growth. And the way we are hardwired, we remember when we get knocked down, when we fall on our butts. We remember that, but we don't remember the fact that every time we get up, thank you very much, and reclaim our lives and keep going, we forget how resilient we really are.
Well, that is a perfect way to end our conversation. Dan Gottlieb, as always, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Marty.
And you can hear Dan's weekly commentaries with Mike and Scott Mondays during Morning Edition right here on WHYY. And Barbie Zelizer, thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. She's an author, Associate Dean Director of the Center for Media at Risk at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. For more information about the show, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.